Hardly any subject is as full of contradictions as rape. Despite the fears of many event organisers that my talks would trigger trauma in the audience, I regularly encounter the complete opposite. As if a dam were breaking, there's often a palpable relief. Listeners tell me personal stories during the lecture, and even more afterward, and the overwhelming feeling is that this subject was just waiting to be pulled out of the closet, dusted off, and re-examined. After all, and I only noticed it at this point, here was something I only ever talked about with friends as something abstract and theoretical, usually when a prominent case was in the media. Any connection to our own lives seemed to be carefully avoided, except our fear of dark streets at night. This lack of language is usually interpreted as shame, that our experiences are too painful and embarrassing to share outside of protected spaces. But how did that correlate with the complete strangers of all sexes who came to me after each lecture and talked to me about what I could not talk about with my friends? That is a passage from the book Rape by today's guest, Meetu Sanyal. This is The Gender Knot. I am Naz.
I'm Dan. Welcome. We're doing it. We're going deep. We're going to talk about how to talk about rape.
Yeah, so this is a big topic. I feel like just because of the conversations that are happening the past 2 years about sexual assault and stuff, it's great that we're talking about these things more, but how do we even open that all up? So today's guest is Meetu Sanyal. She has written a book called, it's simply called Rape. It's really good. Everyone should pick up a copy. So actually, I think she wrote this, 2 years ago, because it's originally in German. She's German. So it's just come out in English. And I think I read it in about 2 or 3 sittings. It's really, really good. So we've linked to it in the show notes. She talks about just lots of stuff. So she goes into, like, you know, the history of a lot of rape myths, where they come from, all the way to sort of how the courts deal with rape, problematic things we expect from rape victims, all the way to, like, you know, how we can better sort of deal with rape as a society. So we were really excited to talk to her. She was here in London a few weeks ago. So she and I met up and we gave you a call, Dan, and we all had a bit of a chat about how to even start talking about rape.
Yeah, we had a chat where I was quiet and uncomfortable, which is, I think, the safe card to play.
But yeah, I feel like this personally comes up for me quite a lot, where both men and women I know, but especially maybe with women that I know, I kind of might suspect that something has happened, and there is that dilemma of, because I'm a big fan of doing something. I hate silence. I hate when people don't want to hurt someone's feelings and they're just silent about, like, a difficult situation. And they're like, oh, I didn't raise this difficult thing because I didn't want to hurt your feelings. I just think silence is the worst thing. So I'm often in this position where I'm like, I suspect something has happened to someone and I think it's the right thing to kind of go there, but should I? Is it my place? How do I do it in a way that's helpful? How do I make clear that if they need to talk about it, they can? Do you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. And especially because, you know, since Me Too, this is women are talking about it more, or knowing that they might have had an experience that was not okay, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, hey, listen, as a fella who's once or twice been intimate with a gal, you know, and with how fucking common this stuff is in life, sadly, I've definitely had to have conversations, because, like, something will happen, someone will say something, someone will, you know, cringe at a reference, or, you know, cry after sex, or, you know, just weird, like, not weird, but just stuff that isn't necessarily, like, the norm will happen in, like, an intimate situation. And I you know, I'm not like you, where I have a hard drive to, like, be out in the open about everything with everyone. I'm fine with silence. But
no, that's not what I mean. I just think it's important to not ignore problems and avoid problems.
Right.
Just make clear that, hey, if you need to talk, it's here.
Right. Provide the space.
Right.
You know,
right.
And that's what it's about for me, is just kind of providing the space. Because one thing I've noticed is that, you know, when it has come up, you know,
When what has come up? The possibility that someone's been raped?
Yeah, the conversation around it. Not so much the possibility, but the conversation that comes after the possibility is confirmed. Do you know what I mean? And okay. So like, hey, has something happened? Yes, something has happened. What often comes up is like a deep shame from the woman. Like I'm not going to want them anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
Or I'm not going to be able to handle this conversation. And that's really sad to me, because that, like, to me, that says that a lot of guys have heard this and been put off.
Right. Yeah.
And that's a real bummer.
Yeah. Something else that came up in the conversation, and you'll all hear it, but Me Too made a really good point about how we're talking a lot about consent when it comes to sex these days, and I personally think that's a really good thing, but you know, so much of our upbringing, especially as women, is to not say what we want and to put other people first and to defer to other people and to please other people, and then yet when it comes to sex, like, there's this expectation that no, you should say what you want and you should, you know, be very clear with what you want and giving consent. And I think that's like a really important point and something that's really overlooked in these conversations. So it's kind of, that's really made me think. I think it's like really worth flagging that and everyone having a bit of a think about that sort of contradiction.
Yeah, it's like don't make the first move, but when you get home, then you want to also not make the first move, but when it comes to sex, be sure to give a clear yes, and I like it like this.
Right, and that the guy is going to necessarily not push and listen. But yeah, we'll go into all that.
Yeah, and last flag. I don't want to say like I think it's obvious, but like this is generally a show about how men and women interact, and so we are talking about, you know, specifically, primarily anyway, rape occurring between men and women, and that's not to give the impression that we don't acknowledge or understand that there are, you know, many forms of rape and sexual assault. That's just kind of not the focus of the show, but maybe, I don't know, depending on feedback or something, we can dive into more of that later on if it comes up. But just want you guys to know we're not like blinded to the rest of what's going on.
Well, basically, we've started talking about it as a public discussion now, and it always used to be a kind of private discussion, and that is great, but it also means that we are we go back to all the old narratives, because we haven't got any new narratives yet. So we reproduce all these ideas about active, aggressive men and passive women and all that. So in any other area of research, we would always question that. We would always say, well, that can't be the case still. And as soon as it's about rape, we go back to gender stereotypes that we thought we had done with in the 70s. And so it is kind of incredibly important to talk about rape, and at the same time, we do tend to reproduce exactly what we want to change.
Okay, so I'm thinking, rape is unfortunately a lot more common than we like to think. So I'm thinking this happens a lot, and Dan, I'm sure you can talk to this as well. Like, this happens a lot where we might be in scenarios where we suspect someone might have been raped or assaulted. How do we open that conversation? Because this has happened with me, like, you know, being in a scenario where I'm like, I think this person might have had an experience. How do I go there in a way that's helpful, that isn't re-traumatizing, that doesn't avoid the topic, but, you know, kind of actually is helpful to the person?
It is incredibly interesting, because when I wrote my book, I noticed I hadn't talked to my girlfriends about the subject. I mean, we talked about it in a general political way, but we didn't talk about personal experiences, and which is absolutely impossible. Of course, some of us, and probably most of us, had some kind of experience of sexual borders being transgressed, but we didn't do that. And after I'd written the book, when I did lectures, usually people come to me afterwards and they tell me their stories. So that is, and I was so overwhelmed by it at the beginning. So how do you react to it? How do you do it well? How do you not basically put somebody into a cupboard and into some kind of box and say, so you're a rape victim, so that's how you are, that's what you are. And what I noticed is as soon as we just start talking about it, people will come to us. And it's not that we have to approach them, because that's the other thing I noticed, that sometimes it is good and it's helpful for your own healing not to call it rape. Sometimes it's incredibly important to call it exactly that. And sometimes it's important because as soon as people use the word rape, it's like a film starts in their minds. What does rape mean? What does being a rape victim mean? And what does it mean for your life? And these stories are usually very detrimental. They are usually equal with breakdown. It can mean breakdown, absolutely. There is something like rape trauma and you have to take it very seriously. But it can also mean people are resilient and they can cope with it, or they can cope with it after a while. And we haven't got any narratives for that. And it's incredibly important to have these narratives. And so we don't have to basically invent it all from zero every time.
So we don't have a narrative of how to approach it. What are your suggestions on how do we create a space where people who have experienced rape or sexual assault can, you know, open up?
I think in a way it has happened with the Me Too movement as well. I've been in so many radio call-in shows and people have called in and talked about incredibly personal stories because they knew they would be listened to. And before it was the other way around, they had to defend themselves. It really happened. And they were, are you sure? Are you sure you didn't get it wrong? All that. So at the moment, there is a climate where it starts to be possible to talk about it. But it's also important that we let all these different stories be heard. And I've been to one lecture where somebody stood up and said, yeah, but what about our own complicity in it? And the room went quiet, so you're not allowed to. And it wasn't that she didn't want to say, yeah, it's all my own fault, but she wanted to speak about her own power in there. And so to even let this happen, and it was really, so everybody had to take a deep breath. Okay, that's what you mean, fine. And that it was really very interesting. So things can grow.
Complicity, you mean she was a victim blaming herself?
She was a victim. But no, I don't think she was blaming herself, but that's what it sounded like.
Okay.
It sounded like, oh, and what is my own part? And she said, yeah, I want to look at my part, not in the way of what have I done wrong? Am I a bad person? Did I deserve it? But as we know from feminist self-defense, if you try to do something, the outcome will change. It doesn't mean nothing will happen to you, but in 90% of the times it will change for the better. So it doesn't mean that, oh, you should have just defended yourself, it's your own fault. It just means there is a possibility for empowerment. We should talk about that.
Okay. And wait, tell me more about this possibility for empowerment. And also in terms of like when we approach people who we think might be victims or who we know are victims and they, you know, want support or something.
Well, first of all, it is usually up to the people themselves to say what kind of support they want. And the first thing that, for example, the rape crisis centers in Germany do is they ask people, what do you call it? What do you call what happened to yourself? And people have loads of different ways of describing it. And it's very important that it's in their hand to define what happened to them. It's not somebody else is doing it from the outside, which is a kind of repetition of the crime.
Some
kind of self-determination is taken away from you. So you can name it. And you're also allowed to name it differently the next time. It's not that you have to tell one story and you've got to stick to that story. No, like everything that happens to us, we approach it again and again and again. This is not a court of law. This is about healing.
Okay.
And a court of law is different, of course, and you've got to be very clear about what's going to happen to you there. And this is not about people being sensitive to you. It is about proving something, which is exactly the opposite of what you need. But this is the way
to heal.
To heal, yeah. I think you do need people to listen to you sympathetically and openly, and then people. And that is what the rape crisis centers say. People will find their own ways of feeling. It's not about helping them. It's about being there and helping them to help themselves. But it's you can't heal somebody, but you can create an environment where it's easier for them to heal themselves. And sometimes it's also important to just be there and to mourn for what happened. And sometimes you do need this kind of collective mourning. And that was what happened after Me Too a bit. There were loads of incredibly positive aspects. There were loads of aspects of Me Too that were difficult and that was grappling with. But this, there was a chance to mourn collectively. And we always hope that would happen in a court of law. It never happens. It's awful. Court of law do exactly the opposite. Because they can't. And after the Me Too movement, there was this feeling of, yeah, we look at what has happened to us and we look at the hurt as well, and we give that space, and then it can go away. Or it can't in some cases, and that is okay as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's not something that's widely understood that, you know, in a situation where something really bad has happened to someone, they don't, like you said, they don't always need to be, like, carried through it. They don't need to be, like, fixed. Like, we can't do the healing for them, is what you said, which I think is remarkable. Like, all we can do is open up a place where they can get the help that they need. And that's the case with, like, just about everything. I'd never heard it put into this context before, though.
But I find that in itself can be tricky, though, because with things like rape, sometimes people don't know how to talk about it, and it is a case of they don't want to re-traumatize the victim, or they feel awkward, so they say nothing, right? And I think that those sorts of silences can be, like, you know, they can add to the trauma, no?
Yeah, but that is like a malady that we all have. We don't want to make mistakes, so we rather do nothing, and making a mistake is still better than doing nothing. I would really like to go back to what you said, Dan, because especially this carrying somebody through is got a kind of taking away agency from them, and right. the crime has taken away usually takes away agency. Let's not generalize here, but in 99% of the case it does take away agency, and that is a big problem. So if you treat someone like they can't act for themselves, that is actually detrimental. And one of the cases that really, really got to me, that the Rape Crisis Center in Düsseldorf, they're brilliant, they're very well known in Germany. So a young woman was sent to them by her mother and her best friend, and she had been raped, and they were really worried that, oh, it will come up again, you're in denial. And Etta Halenga from the Rape Crisis Center, she said, yeah, but what an awful message to give to a young woman. Say, oh, you will be re-traumatized. It will happen to you. Just wait for it. And she said, yeah, it might come. And then you can always come back to us, but it doesn't need to. It's fine. If you are feeling good, you are allowed to feel good. And sometimes people have this feeling they have to have the pain to show something really happened to them.
Okay.
It's like a crime scene. You've got to preserve it. So you will be believed.
Okay.
And that is really awful.
But in this case, the woman, she had been raped, and her mother who had
sent her there, yeah.
And she was saying that, you know, you have to talk about it, otherwise you're going to be re-traumatized or something.
Otherwise it will come up one day, and then, and you are just in denial. If you're feeling good now, that means you are in denial.
Right.
And sometimes it's not the right time to deal with trauma. Sometimes you have to deal with, I don't know, getting your A-levels first, and right. then you can deal with trauma, or getting your child through the first couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you can choose when you want to look at things, and it's your time, it's up to you yourself. But you said about talking to people. I think, yeah, it is incredibly important, but it's also, once we start talking about ourselves, people usually start opening up to us, and always this, oh, I know something has happened to you, that it usually goes wrong.
No, but I'm not saying that. I'm saying, how do we create a space where people know that should they want to talk or raise it, they can?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Yeah. By not just talking about the subject when it comes up, by it is part of our everyday life. And when I was writing about the book, we always talk about prevention, and it's also the way we genuinely deal with borders. We're always taught, oh, don't make a fuss, don't be so difficult. And then suddenly when it's a sexual situation, we are supposed to communicate incredibly clearly about our borders. No, we should talk about consent a lot earlier, for example. So, and what does consent mean? Because we're growing up in a compromise culture. So everybody gives something up and we meet in the middle. But if I want to have sex with you and you don't want to have sex with me, we can't have a little bit of sex and that would be a compromise. No.
Yeah, just like 70-30.
Absolutely. And the idea of consent culture is if both sides say very clearly what they want and what they need, there will be a third thing that they both actually really want. Because if you had sex with me and I wouldn't want to have sex with you, that would be the worst thing you could do to me, really. And but in our culture, people who give things up, who walk over their borders, they're considered to be the good ones. And the ones who say what they want, they're the egotistical ones. They're the bad ones. But you need to be able to say what you really want so you can get to that third level.
But this is interesting because this is where it's quite gendered, right? Because with women, it's like, you know, very much taught to, you know, put others first, not say what you want because there can be consequences for that. And also the whole thing of like, and this happens with not even just sex, even with courting. Like, you know, you say no to a guy and they keep pushing and they keep pushing and that's almost like more impetus to try. So that's kind of, I think that's what makes
it's incredibly gendered, absolutely. And it's also, it doesn't stop there. You don't just have to say what you want and then you automatically, it's also you have to listen to what the other person says and you kind of have to understand what they say. I think the problem with courting is that we are still living in a culture that tells us that no means you've got to try harder.
And for the man?
For the man, yeah, yeah. And that's got a lot to do with when I read any self-help book about dating, it says, oh, play hard to get. Oh,
to the woman?
To the woman, yeah, yeah. Okay. And so you all know the three-day rule. If you'd had sex, you've got to wait for 3 days before you call them, else he will think you're too keen on it, because obviously men only want to have sex with women who don't want to have sex with them. Whatever, why ever, bullshit. So all these, we learn that. We say, oh, if a woman is too keen, that will take away the pleasure of the hunt. I don't know why you go to a club if you want to hunt, you could go on safari. No, you shouldn't go on safari either. Anyway, but basically, we all learn these sexual courting rules. And I do a lot of consent workshops, and very often young men actually tell me they are insecure, and half the time when they get a no, they think, oh, I really like to accept that, I don't want rejection. But they're told by society, if you don't try again, she will think you don't mean it.
Right.
And that is, and I was really surprised about that, because I always thought, what part of no don't you understand? And I got it, but these are all cultural codes, and there are loads of different cultural codes, and we don't know which ones we're operating with. And I've talked to my husband, who basically, actually, the first time I said no, and then he gave up, and so it took us 9 years before we got together, finally, because he really thought, yeah, that's what she means. And I had been brought up to not be too keen. So I was incredibly warm and friendly to men I wasn't interested in, and very distant to men I was interested in. So I always had loads of problems in my life, obviously.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
And I speak to students now, and they've still got some similar experiences. So they can't be normal with people they're interested in. They are very distant. And
is this women or
This is mainly women, but there are more and more young men as well. Mm-hmm. Because I did a lecture the other day, and they said, oh, young men, they haven't changed for the last 50 years. And yes, they have. Massively. I mean, the laws have changed. Everything has changed. The way they're growing up. If they haven't changed, then we've done something wrong. Then feminism hasn't worked. But for them, they haven't got as many alternative gender roles as women have.
Okay.
And so they are really at a loss at the moment. So they know what not to do, but they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. So I've got quite a lot of young men in my classes who've never had sex, because they don't want to push too hard, but the women don't make the first move. So they are really, they're incredibly, and it is a problem.
What ages are we talking?
Oh, early to mid-20s.
Okay.
It's tough, yeah, because like you don't know what to do. Like, do you make a move? Do you, like, does no actually mean go away, or does it mean try harder? It's a very interesting, and I mean that in like a dating way. Obviously, when we're talking about sexual consent, no is a very specific word, but
I always thought you need a safe word. It shouldn't be no. It should be something like, I don't know, pancakes or something. Because then we know, oh, that's really the safe word now, and we can play with the no. And sometimes it is interesting to play with the no, but I've become very clear now. But what mainly I try to teach people to say yes, and I think that's even more important, because most of my female students, they don't know what they want, and that is more dangerous in a way. So they have to wait for the other person to basically choose their sexuality for them.
Right.
And especially if it's taking. So we do loads of role play stuff. So if it's about how do you want to touch another person so it's interesting for you. I want to give you a massage. No, how do you want to touch another person so you get something? And they don't even understand the question.
Right.
And that is not all of them, obviously, but that is really interesting, because we've learned if you take something sexually, that's bad, that's taking away. But no, that is sexy. If somebody touches us because they find that interesting, and if we are into them too, that is really interesting. So there's a whole part of sexuality that is kind of denied by society. Obviously, not all women deny that to themselves, but and it's awful, because you're talking in a very cis way now here. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you talk about rape, you really go into very drastic generals. There's only two genders, and that's mm-hmm. not true either. But because, yeah, we are kind of going back to these old narratives. So half of their sexuality is denied by them. So they're waiting for somebody else to call the shots sexually. And that is a problem too. So I want to talk about sexual self-determination more, because that gets us to something positive, more than I want to talk about what not to do, because the list will grow longer and longer and longer. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you learn to communicate sexually, and that's the other thing. Most of the people I know, they find a partner, and they find a way of making love, but they never talk about things they would like to try out. They never... The only people I know who do that are the BDSM people. They really have developed the language, and all the others are just, yeah, it's boring. Yeah.
So it's about being passive, like women being passive with what they want, well, and not knowing what they want, maybe.
Well, men are too.
That's nice to hear.
I mean, if that's the conversation we're having of like people don't have a language, I mean, the men in those situations don't have a language either, like outside of what you said, like the BDSM community, where people have very specific words for like everything. I think men and women are both lacking in like a way of honestly saying, this is what I like to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
To the point where often they don't even understand it themselves, because they've never been able to put it into words and communicate it comfortably to a partner to actually like explore it.
And I still grew up with this idea that a man is going to give me an orgasm. No man can give me an orgasm. I can give myself an orgasm while we are having sex. But this is bullshit to sit there and wait for someone to give you an orgasm and all that. So it starts incredibly early on.
Mm-hmm.
So just to how do we explore our own sexuality? And I mean... we've been doing some kind of activism about the clitoris model, that most people don't even know what the clitoris really looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so we still have all these conversations about the clitoral or the vaginal orgasm. It's all the same orgasm. It's just that you stimulate the clitoris from the inside or from the outside. It's really big. And so if you don't know what our sexual organs, how they're constructed, it is also harder to give ourselves pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And to have the feeling of, this body belongs to me. This is my body, and I can play with it. I've got a ride. And that is my main problem at the moment with the rhetoric around Me Too, that it has got this undertow of, oh, we've got to protect women from sexuality. And I want sexual self-determination. I don't want to be protected. And some of my friends, their kids, they are complaining, their daughters are complaining that when they had they drank alcohol, and then their boyfriend puts them in a taxi and says, no, then you can't give informed consent. But if I had had to wait until I was sober, I would have had sex a lot later. And sometimes it is important to try that out as well. And human beings are porous beings, so we only notice our borders in contact. It's not I'm a being with my borders here. If I'm in jail, if I'm if you're in singular confinement, what's that?
Solitary
confinement, exactly. Then I lose the ability to even perceive the room. If I want to grab a bottle of water, I can't really grab it. The walls start to ripple. Mm-hmm. Very, very soon, we need other human beings to feel ourselves. So even to find out our borders, we need to experiment, we need to find out. That doesn't mean we need to experience rape, absolutely not. But if in this no means in this yes means yes, you always say, oh, if somebody isn't sure, then don't do it. No, if somebody isn't sure, maybe do it carefully and keep in contact and keep checking. It's not, oh, then I won't do this and I won't do this, and then you only have the good sex, the one you really want. No, that's not the case. And you will end up with very little sex. And that is a problem. We only find out what kind of sex we want by doing it. And when we feel safe enough to say, oh, this isn't feeling well, we've got to stop. That's important too.
So we talked about how do we talk about rape with Meetu Sanyal, who's just written a book called Rape. Do check it out. I am Naz.
I'm Dan. Our co-producers are Jonathan Blackwell and Sam Baker. We forgot to say it at the top of the show, but you should write to us, thegendernot@gmail.com. Love talking about vulnerability. Love talking about emotional labor. Never gets old. Keep sending it in.
And share this show.
And share it. Why not?
Yeah, share it now. Okay, we're back next week. Speak soon.
Okay, miss you. Bye.